Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and my guest today is Tayari Jones. She's the author, most recently, of An American Marriage. There are those of you out there who are going to be saying, isn't that the Oprah Winfrey book? And yes, it's the most recent book in the Oprah Winfrey Book Club, and it's a marvelous novel, An American Marriage. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. It has basically three central characters, each of whom speak in the course of the book. To me, when I read about a woman who makes dolls that look like her husband-to-be, Roy, whose name is Celestial, I just fell in love with them. Roy is going to make Celestial dolls into a whole business, a fortune. He wants to sell them. He wants them to be perfect. He wants to help her become what she most wants to be, an artist. And here is a man and a wife-to-be practicing perfection. If they can. They go off on essentially a honeymoon. The husband, who is something of a, what do you call it? A flirt.
He's a lot of things. I think he is. He's a little bit of a flirt. He's, you know, I think he's the kind of man who has been loved all his life. You know, his mother adores him when he goes to high school. His teachers want him to see the world. Like, he's just, I think it's possible to be over-cherished.
Well, he goes to get an ice bucket at the hotel where they're staying. Because of his basic politeness, he offers to help a woman in the soda and ice room carry her ice bucket back to her room. He rejoins his wife. Later that night, there's a pounding at their door, and he's taken off. The woman has claimed that he's raped her. There's no evidence of this being the case. He's been with his wife since he came back to the room, and she doesn't think that he's been anywhere, but the police will believe neither of them. There's a terrible essence in this book that the black man is never believed. He's taken to court. He's given a 12-year sentence. And what a book. She, Celestial, the wife, Roy's wife, has grown up with a man named Andre, and they were bathed in the sink together.
Yes.
And, well, 12 years is an awfully long time to wait, even though, as it turns out, he gets freed after 5 years. But the question is, would you wait for me if I were put in jail? And he says to his wife, hey, you wouldn't have been put in jail. You wouldn't be in this situation. So this is an examination of a black marriage with all of the guilt and impossibility that comes with attempting to be a successful black couple in America. Why does this happen to them?
Well, I mean, it is true, as someone says to Roy, you know, you were at the wrong race at the wrong time. And they are, you know, they are a successful couple, but they are not all that unique in Atlanta, you know, where I'm from. And they're just, they are the embodiment of the New South and the American dream when this lightning bolt strikes their life. And it just, they're in Louisiana, which incarcerates more of its citizens than any other place in the world when it happens. They're visiting his family. And they're constantly questioning themselves, like if they had stayed at his mother's house instead of staying in a hotel, maybe this wouldn't have happened. If they hadn't argued and he hadn't gone out to get some fresh air and go to the ice machine, maybe this wouldn't happen. Like they take on to themselves the guilt about something that isn't either of their faults.
This is the nightmare of the inexplicability of race in America.
Yes. I mean, all my life, I've always felt like prison is the boogeyman under the bed. Like it could come for, you know, the men in my life at any moment. And also, I think that I was really interested in the idea of eyewitness testimony and misidentification. As Roy even says, someone attacked that woman. It just wasn't me. It was important to me that I not write a completely fabricated allegation against him. It wasn't him. He was convicted, and in my imagination, he was a victim of a rigged lineup. And that's one thing was fascinating in my research, is that if you see a bad lineup, the victim will believe the person is the person, even if the person isn't the person. And the thing about eyewitnesses, they're such a nightmare because eyewitnesses are at once passionate, convincing, and unreliable. Eyewitnesses frequently are, as we say in Atlanta, they are strong and wrong.
Wow. Andre has been in Celestial's life.
He is the literal boy next door.
And he realizes that he loves her.
He's loved her since he was a baby.
But he wasn't going to get in the way of their marriage. It's only when that marriage is interrupted by imprisonment that he says, wait, you're not going to wait 12 years.
Well, no, that's not fair. No, he was respecting those boundaries, and she decided she wasn't going to wait for 12 years. As a matter of fact, he said, are you sure? It was important to me that her consent be full-bodied in this case. He does not make a case for himself. I wonder, even if Roy had not been incarcerated, maybe she would have eventually come around to Andre. The boy next door, I mean, that's the boy you don't want when you're young, when you want that kind of plate-throwing passion, you know? Like Celestial and Roy, they have an intense relationship, but it's very youthful, I think, in a lot of ways. And she's known Andre all her life. Like I said, he's the boy next door. I sometimes joke that the reason they put boys next door in the first place is so that you can grow up and figure out that you want to marry them.
Did you know how the book would end?
Oh, I never have any idea of what the plot points will be in a novel until I start writing them. But the end of this book was particularly challenging. I was stranded. I was stranded about 50 pages from the end for a year. It was horrible. It was as though me and this book were in a relationship in New York City and we had broken up, but we couldn't afford to move out. So I was stuck with the book. It was like the book was sleeping on my couch. I wasn't speaking to it. It wasn't speaking to me. I couldn't start a new book because I had a book on my couch. But I realized that the reason I was frozen is that I had accidentally let Roy's point of view take over my own point of view. Roy is under the impression that this book will end when he is able to take stock of everyone. He believes that, he believes he's lost everything, his job, his wife, his home, his status, his time. And he thinks the moral measure of the universe of this story is who can give this back to him. And he's taking names and keeping score for everyone in his life. What can they do to restore what has been taken from him. But I realize that what has been taken from him among these things, but more important perhaps, is that he has forgotten that he is a person that has something to contribute to his relationships, that he needs to ask what he can do for these people who he loves and who have loved him. And when you forget that you can contribute, that's when you've been destroyed. And so when I realized this, I knew that the book would end with an act of generosity on his part. And then I was able to finish the book in just a few days.
How many years did it take?
Six.
6 years.
Yes. It took me longer to write this book than Roy spent in jail. How about that?
That makes complete sense to me. Now, this is your fourth book.
Yes.
Do I have that right? And the second book to be published by the Algonquin Press. And in your acknowledgments, you hail them and salute them. What does the Algonquin Press mean to you?
Well, I had always wanted to be published by Algonquin, even for my first two books, because I consider myself to be a Southern writer. I was born and raised in Atlanta. And when I wrote my first book in 2002, Algonquin was at Chapel Hill Press. And I really wanted to be published there, but it didn't work out. I was published by another house. But it matters to me, this regional representation. And now, because Algonquin has offices in New York City as well as in Chapel Hill, I feel like it kind of captures my sensibility, which is as an urban person who is also a Southern person. I felt like it was the best of both worlds.
Well, to my surprise, one of the people associated with Algonquin Press is Michael McKenzie, who I knew for many years as a publicist at another New York publisher. And he's come here with you, and I thought it would be interesting to have my listeners know a little bit more about Algonquin Books. Michael, tell me.
Hi, how are you?
It's a pleasure to see you.
Thanks
again.
Thanks for having me. And it's great to be here with TRI. I would just say I think that people did used to know Algonquin as a Southern publisher, but I think it's grown and become so much more than that. I think there's still a bit of a foundation in that Southern literature, if you will, with the Lee Smiths of the world and Jill McCorkles and Larry Browns, et cetera. But I think now it's become, as I mentioned, so much more. I mean, Algonquin was the first press to publish Chimamanda Adichie with Purple Hibiscus.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my. That's wonderful.
Algonquin published Leilani, I forget how many years ago. And more recently, Lisa Coe's The Leavers, which was a National Book Award finalist in 2017. Yeah, so it's become a much broader and sort of more diverse, if you will, press. And it's representative of, I think, the entire country and beyond, as opposed to what it started off as back in the 80s.
Michael McKenzie of the Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, now with offices in New York City. Now, Tayari Jones, your first book to be published with the Algonquin Press was Silver Sparrow. When they accepted it, was that a major time of celebration for you?
Picture this. I had written two novels. I thought they were pretty good. I was pleased with them. I was aware that I wasn't a bestseller. You know, a person notices that she doesn't have any money, but I was very pleased. I felt like I was doing my life's work. But when it came time for me to get a contract for my third book, I couldn't get a deal from anyone. I was just rejected all over town. And I was so disheartened by this because I thought my books were pretty good. They've been reviewed well. Well, imagine this. I had one speaking engagement remaining on my agenda. I went to do that speaking engagement. I read from Silver Sparrow. It wasn't published yet. I just, you know, read a couple of chapters, not a couple of pages, really. And afterwards, a woman approached me and said that she knew about all my publishing trials and tribulations, and she said she thought she could help me. Now, anyone who's been on a book tour knows that all kinds of strange people approach you on a book tour with all manner of strange suggestions. So I didn't know if she had a printing press in her basement or what. However, she took me by the hand and she led me through the crowd and she put my hand in the hand of the publisher of Algonquin Books, Elizabeth Charlotte. And I recognized Miss Charlotte because I'm such an admirer of Algonquin Books. But I wasn't optimistic because I knew that my track record in publishing wasn't so great and I felt that I would be rejected by Algonquin just as I had been rejected all over town. However, Miss Charlotte had been in the audience and heard me read, and also she held the woman who introduced us in high esteem. I didn't know the woman, so when I was leaving, Miss Charlotte said, "Before you go, tell me, how do you know Judy?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know anyone named Judy." And she said, no, I mean Judy Blum, who introduced us."
Oh, my.
And it was as though my nerdy childhood had come to rescue me in my time of need. And that was on a Friday. And by Tuesday, you know, we were all in love. And I had a contract with Algonquin Books, which is my dream press.
Oprah Winfrey chose this as an Oprah's Book Club book. And this is probably the most successful book that Algonquin has ever had.
No, they've had bigger books.
Have they, Michael?
Water for Elephants by Sarah Gruen is a pretty big hit from, almost 15 years ago. Robbie Gulrich with A Reliable Wife was also a pretty massive hit. There have been a few, but this is definitely one of our very biggest books and one that I think we're incredibly proud to have published.
I have also read Silver Sparrow, the previous book, and this is a book that also asks a version of the same question here in an American marriage.
You think?
Oh, yes.
Talk to me.
A woman who narrates the first half of the book has a father who has been married to and is still married to his first wife. And the question is, can you make a choice between two very similar circumstances? Celestial has a choice between two men, and they're both fascinating men to her. This heroine has a choice between fathers and a war with a sister by the other marriage. And I found myself fascinated when I got to part two of Silver Sparrow to find out, I'm going to hear this story from another point of view. And I think that that is very important to you, that stories be told from other sides, that we see things not as simply as we thought we were going to see them.
Well, voice work is my favorite thing to do in a novel. I love trying to figure out the way that characters use language to reflect their, not only their personality, but their worldview. And in Silver Sparrow, the story, the first half is narrated by Dana, who is James's secret daughter. And all her life, she's known that she can never say her father's name. When she's a little girl, she says to him, when she finds out that he has another family, you know, when you're little, whatever your family is, you think is normal. So she quite innocently says, "Oh, your wife and your other little girl is a secret?" And he says to her, "No,
you
are the one that's the secret."
That's such a shock.
And it's such, you know, to
took my breath away.
To have a secret is different than to be a secret. And so she narrates the story. And as I was writing her part, I got to a point where she had exhausted all she could tell me because she does not know what his life is like in his public home. And so if I wanted to know what was going on in that public home, I had to ask the other sister to tell me.
I'm talking to Tayari Jones. We're talking primarily about her book, An American Marriage. It's published by the Algonquin Press. And we have here the publicist for the whole of Algonquin Press, the director of publicity, Michael McKenzie. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Tayari Jones about her book, An American Marriage. With her is the director of publicity for the publisher, Algonquin Books, Michael McKenzie. An American Marriage is a suspenseful and tragic three-person love story with multi-directional sympathies laid bare. Tell me, when you were writing it, did you feel the way I did? I felt so much sympathy for Roy. I wanted him to be rescued like nobody's business.
How could you not feel sympathy for Roy? He had his whole life laid out before him. He said like endless reams of blank paper, and he always had a pen. And everything is taken from him. Of course you want him to be rescued.
So was part of the problem of ending this book your knowledge that in a novel, if the novel is going to be any good, rescue doesn't work. No one can really be rescued.
You know, it's true, but you can rescue yourself in a way. I really feel at the end of this book, we had to look to Mick Jagger.
Yes. Why is that?
You know what Mick Jagger told us.
He told you can't always get what you want.
But sometimes you get what you need. Uh-huh. And that is the key to this book. That is the key to the personal struggles. I mean, in some ways, this is a coming of age story, even though the characters are in their 30s, because they are entering the next phase of life, a more sober phase of life when they have come to understand that thing, that what you think you want may not be what you need. And what you thought happiness would look like, or what your ideal case scenario is, not the same. It's kind of like, you know, when you're a kid, when I was a very young person, I really wanted to own a yellow Corvette very much. And for a long time, I had in the back of my mind was like, I'm a person who wants a yellow Corvette. I don't want a yellow Corvette, but I had to come to realize that what I thought I wanted, I don't want. You know, I want just a simple car now. So I think that all these characters, their idea of what love would look like and marriage, they had kind of yellow Corvette ideas. And this is something that happens to everyone. I mean, this story, and this is what I thought was the challenge of writing this story, and also what I think makes it meaningful, is that, yes, they face the specter of wrongful incarceration. They come up against institutionalized racism. But many of their struggles and lessons are the same lessons we all must learn. Like, their lives are normal lives that intersected with this structural injustice. But still, the questions they ask, I feel like it's a matter of scale. They are asking the same questions we all are, but it's like the volume is turned up to 20. And for the rest of us, the volume is around 8.5.
Now, this book was chosen by Oprah Winfrey.
Yes, it was.
And I want to tell you something. She and her magazine did what is to date, after 30 years of my show, the longest and most detailed profile of me. And I've always felt very grateful to her. She's a real reader.
Yes, absolutely.
How did your initial conversations with her go?
Well, you know, I imagine there are so many pleasures to being Oprah Winfrey. We can't even imagine. But one of them is that, you know, she enjoys changing people's lives and she likes to surprise you with it. So I was driving my car, minding my business, and I received a block call. And I answer block calls because I believe every block call is a story. Someone blocked it for a reason. Usually it's not a good reason, but it's still a reason. So I answered it. I said, hello. And the person on the other end said, hey, this is Oprah. And I am from the state of Georgia. And Oprah, as you know, is from the state of Mississippi. So I said, ma'am? And she said, I read your book. I would like it to be part of my book club. What do you think about that? And I said, yes, ma'am, that would be nice. And then she told me the reasons why she liked it, how she came across it, all of this type of thing. This was 5 months before the book was published, and I had to keep it a secret for 5 months.
Oh, wow. Now tell me, Michael McKenzie, did you know that
I called him.
So you had to be patient, too.
I woke him up. I called him because it was about 9 o'clock Vegas time. So that's midnight Michael time. And I called him up. I said, Michael. And I think he said something like, he was sleepy. He said something like, it better be Oprah. And I said, it was. It was Oprah, Michael. It was Oprah.
I think that is what happened. Uh-huh. And then we just tried to figure out how we were going to keep the secret for that long.
I don't think it's respectful to read a writer's book without reading on the show, without reading all the books. So I've gotten all of the books, not just all of the books, but I've gotten all of them in hardcover. Hardcover first editions, because that's the way I like to read a book. And it becomes really harder to get a first edition if it's an Oprah Winfrey book, because suddenly there are so many copies. So I want to congratulate the two of you for having this hugely successful book. Anyway, two of you, it's a pleasure to have you here. It's a pleasure to celebrate Tayari Jones's An American Marriage and the wonderful press, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We had a good time.
It was fun. I did too.
Same. I'm not used to this, but same.
I've been talking with Tayari Jones and Michael McKenzie. Tayari Jones is the author of An American Marriage, published by Algonquin Books. Michael McKenzie is the director of publicity for Algonquin Books. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. It's also broadcast in Berlin. You can listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Nafissa Thompson Spires is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.